Thanks, Jim. Well, it's, I'm pleased to be here. I see a lot of familiar faces from previous meetings on granular mechanics and so on. So perhaps it's a good thing that I'm not speaking about my usual topic, which is, I think, what Jim invited me to talk about, that being debris flows and rock avalanches. Many of you have heard a lot of that before. And instead, I'm going to be speaking about what's been happening at Mount St. Helens over the last 7 months, and in particular, how granular mechanics actually, in my view, plays a very important role in regulating the nature of this eruption. It's been a really remarkable and unusual volcanic eruption, and poses lots of interesting, and I think tractable, mechanical problems because of its regular nature as opposed to irregular nature. So, a lot of you probably haven't tracked this very closely. In the early days of the eruption, it was making a lot of headlines. There was a tremendous amount of press coverage. The eruption really sort of formally began on October 1st, last fall, and began with a small explosion. Prior to this time, there had been several days of increased seismicity and so on, but really not a lot in the way of foretelling that this kind of activity was going to be happening. Certainly none of us who work at the Volcano Observatory expected this to happen after the volcano had been quiescent for the last 18 years.
That's a confession of failure.
We expected it a few days in advance based on the increased seismicity, but there was no other indication prior to that. So after that first little explosion, which really was quite minor by volcanic standards, we went out and looked at the crater, and what you can see, or what we were able to see, is that there was a small explosion pit or crater in this location. And right adjacent to that, there was this evidence of something pushing up underneath this glacier. This is a glacier that had actually grown in the crater since the mountain last stopped erupting in 1986. And this in itself, this problem in itself, I think, poses an interesting problem in granular mechanics that would be very relevant to volcanologists, and that is simply the problem of an intruder pushing up from depth into a granular medium. It's a quasi-static problem, but one that typically geophysicists address simply by doing elastic calculations. And of course, the reality is that it's much more of a granular mechanics problem with irreversible deformation and so on. And probably would go a long way towards helping us constrain the nature of intrusions that are leading to extrusions if we knew more about characteristic patterns of deformation and faulting in the vicinity of an intruder. The seismicity that has accompanied this eruption is distributed spatially like this. It's all very shallow seismicity, really nothing at depth, even though we know the magma chamber that feeds Mount St. Helens is located down here at about 8 to 10 kilometers depth. We know that from previous eruptions and seismicity. But any deformation that's been seismic in nature, in this case, has been restricted to the upper 2 kilometers, and most of it really within the upper 1 kilometer near the surface, and it's all been located right beneath the crater, where you would expect.
Sorry, how long can one image that?
What's that?
How long can one actually image that? What sort of?
Well, it's an elastic inverse problem, and what ultimately limits the resolution of doing the inversion is the velocity model, knowing the velocity of the wave propagation through the material. If you had a perfect, linearly elastic homogeneous material, you could do it very precisely. But the problem, of course, is that there's a diversity of materials out there, and so when you do the inversion, you're limited by your lack of knowledge of the wave speeds. And so that scatter that you saw could be an artifact of uncertainty, basically. It could be that the seismicity is actually much more tightly clustered than that. And in fact, I think it probably is.
So you think that's also sort of comparable to the error bars in a sense?
Yeah, in a sense, that's an indicator of the error bars. If you look at the sort of the overall seismic intensity during the last 7 months, this is a measurement using something called RSAM, which is a rather crude tool. RSAM stands for real-time seismic amplitude monitoring. And it's simply a measure of how much ground motion there is, sort of averaged over some window and then taking a running average through time. But it gives you some feel, sort of a qualitative feel, for the overall level of seismicity that's accompanying the activity. You can see that as the eruption started, there was a big spike in seismicity that lasted several days, and that was associated with this material pushing through pushing through the ground, what was unbroken ground initially, and that's, again, sort of this intruder problem of the magma making its way to the surface. But once magma reached the surface, the remarkable thing is that the overall seismic amplitude here, dating clear back to mid-October, has been remarkably steady, remarkably constant level of seismic activity, and that's all associated with dome extrusion. In other words, with the appearance of new rock at the surface.
Is this steady state much larger than it was before the eruption started?
Yes, much larger than it was before. The level of seismicity, well, here you can get some impression here. It was essentially zero on this scale prior to the eruption.
Why? The noise level seems to have increased. Is that a change in the signal?
That could be an artifact of sort of the windowing that's used to calculate this sort of running average, although I'm not certain of that. It could be that there actually is a higher noise level. Not certain. Okay, here's the thing that's really remarkable about the seismicity. This is a 12-hour sample of the seismicity. This is a 12-hour seismogram that you read like a book. You read it from left to right and from top to bottom. The colors here don't really mean anything. They're just a visual aid to help you distinguish separate traces. But as you march along through time here, you can basically see that these earthquakes were occurring about once a minute. So here we have earthquake, calm, earthquake, calm, and so on. And this goes on and on. And in fact, that's been going on repetitively now for about 7 months. And this is really, really remarkable. For those of you who aren't geophysicists, it's very seldom in geophysics that you see anything this repetitive. And that, of course, makes it very interesting.
Could we not go back now that we know there's something every minute and look at the previous slide to see the time scale on that?
Very different time scale. Yeah. So here we're looking at how many months? 5 months.
This was absent before the eruption event happened?
No, this is during the eruption. This seismicity is actually during the eruption. So this is accompanying the extrusion of rock.
How large? Can you give us a sense of how big each of those?
These are small earthquakes. These are mostly between magnitude 1 and 2. And the magnitude scale for earthquakes is a logarithmic scale. So these are many, many orders of magnitude smaller than a big tectonic earthquake. And probably, in most cases, small enough that you wouldn't even feel these if you were standing in the crater. You might feel a few of the larger ones.
So out of curiosity, I mean, if you take a wooden beam and you overload it, such that it's going to go, but it takes time, you're going to crack, 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 and you know to get out and go away.
I don't know that it would be sort of periodic, though. Usually, rupture processes, I think, are sort of more chaotic rather than periodic. And that's what I find it so intriguing about this, is that it is this sort of semi-periodic kind of process. And here, it does evolve to some degree. Here's a sampling of data from a different window of time. And you can see that the period between the earthquakes has shifted here a little bit. It's getting closer, perhaps, to 2 minutes than 1 minute. And you can see that the earthquakes here are a bit larger on average than they were in that previous slide. So the total energy release is probably comparable from slide to slide, but the period has shifted a bit. And occasionally mixed in, there are these larger earthquakes. This one is probably a magnitude greater than 2, which is large enough that it would be felt in the crater. And in my view, it probably represents a different process, because these are infrequent. These larger earthquakes occur maybe once a day at most. Whereas these so-called drumbeat earthquakes, as we've nicknamed them, have occurred very repetitively now for 7 months.
But the large earthquake was on time for a drumbeat.
At least that particular one looks like it was. Not all of them have been. Sometimes the larger earthquakes occurred almost on top of a drumbeat.
It's been following it, very little activity.
Yeah, it was much quieter after the
period. It was quiet there for a period, yeah. At least in this instance. Again, I'm not sure that that's representative. Okay, so here's what's actually appeared on the ground surface during all this activity. This rock here, this segment, including this smooth whaleback feature, as we call it, is all new. It's all extruded since early October, and that's about 50 million cubic meters of material. And what that represents is a continuous extrusion rate of something like 2 cubic meters a second for 7 months now. So it's a tremendous volume of rock. But it's come out of the ground, interestingly, as a solid state extrusion. It's not coming out as liquid magma. It's coming out of the ground as solid rock, and it's coming out of the ground right here. So this is essentially the vent area, and the surrounding material here is basically rubble that's smalled off this smooth whaleback feature.
The smooth whaleback is rock.
It's rock. No, that's all solid rock. This is that's new rock. Around the perimeter here, this is glacier. The white material here and over here is glacier. This feature here is the old lava dome from the 1980s eruption of Mount St. Helens. So this was constructed between 1980 and 1986. Then the mountain shut off, and this new activity is what built this feature here.
How far down would you be?
Best guess is something like half a kilometer to a kilometer is probably where you hit the transition to liquid. That's based on inferences about the petrology, the mineralogy, and so forth of the rocks, and also based on the seismic data, because at least my view is that the seismicity is being generated at depths where there's already been this transition to solid state behavior as opposed to liquid beneath that. Okay, here's a set of vertical photographs or images showing you the sequence of this extrusion. So this is before activity began, a view in 2003. Here's the glacier filling the back part of the crater. Here's the old dome from the 1980s. And the new dome will start to appear in this region right here. So you can see it growing. Here's the first appearance of this whaleback feature. You can see that continuing to grow, and then it sort of breaks apart from time to time, regrows as it comes out of the ground, out of the vent, breaks apart again, and so on. And right now it's in sort of a breaking apart mode, subsequent to that last photo I showed you, which was taken in March. So again, here's the basic picture. Here's the newly extruded rock, the whaleback, the deformed glacier, and the old dome. And I'm now going to show you a series of photos, time-lapse photos shot from the ground in a location right here that we call Sugar Bowl, looking up towards this new dome as it's being extruded. And you can actually see this thing coming up and out of the ground over a 3-day time period. So I'll show you a sequence of photos, time-lapse, over a total interval of about 3 days. And if you look at the whaleback feature here, and focus closely on some of these particular features, cracks and so on, you can actually see this moving up and out of the ground. Back it up. So that's 3 days of motion. And we actually know how fast that's moving, or at least for certain time intervals, we know how fast it's moving, because we've been able to place real-time GPS units on top of that dome and basically track its motion. It was a helicopter.
Yeah.
It's a little, we call these things spiders, and you'll see that, I think, in the next photo. Here's a close-up of one of these spiders. It's basically a three-legged instrument that we drop from a helicopter on a cable. Landed here, and then if everything works, we're able to transmit the data back to our observatory. And so as this dome moves along, the spider moves with it, and you see something about it. Oh yeah, this is locally very hot. In fact, I'll show you an infrared image in a little bit that shows that some of these cracks have temperatures as high as 700 degrees C, which is one of the reasons you don't want to be out here. And one of the reasons also that these spiders tend not to have very long lives. So we don't have a continuous record of displacement because the spiders either get, they fall into a crack, or in some cases they've been removed by an explosion and so on. Anyway, here is a record of a 10-day period when we actually had a GPS spider on the dome or on the whaleback. And you can see that the dominant component of motion up in that location was horizontal here. And you can see that over the course of these 10 days, that moved about 82 meters horizontally. So a rough estimate of the magnitude of the movement rate is about 10 meters a day. And that's been true whenever we've been able to measure this with any degree of resolution. So you can kind of keep that in mind as a typical rate, about 10 meters a day. Here's this infrared image. Looking kind of at a side view of the whaleback dome here. Here's the view in the visible spectrum, and then here's the infrared image. And these hotter temperatures that you see here, we always see a hot rind right where it's coming out of the ground, which isn't very surprising. Typically, this hot rind is on the order of 200 to 300 degrees C. But the hottest places that we measure are often in these cracks, these localized cracks, and that's where sometimes you have temperatures as hot as 600 or 700 degrees C, which isn't that far from the solidus temperature for this material. The solidus temperature is maybe 900 degrees C. So it could be that within this thing there's actually some degree of molten core, although we don't really know that.
If you look at this at night, knowing not particularly, just take it out, you see the...
Sometimes you see a glow, but usually only when there's been some kind of a recent avalanching event that's removed some of the surface rock. Otherwise, it's just dark at night. So here's the base of the whaleback coming out of the ground. For scale, this is about 80 meters in width. And an important feature that you can see here is the striated, grooved surface of this whaleback. These large-scale structural features that tell us that there's some kind of grinding or a frictional interaction going on as this material pushes its way out of the ground. And if we look at that close up, we're now looking right at the contact where the whaleback comes out of the ground close up. And in fact, what you see is that the surface of this thing is made up of a granulated rock material, or fault gouge, as we call it. I've actually got a little sample of this here. If you want to come and look at it, or for that matter, I can pass it around. It's very fine-grained, granular material, not unlike other fault gouges that you'd find in other settings. And again, you see that it's grooved and striated. In some places, it's more solid than it is in other places. But basically, I view this as being a granular material that's responsible for the frictional interaction of the moving plug with the wall rocks around it.
From the fact that the shape of the horizontal striations is the same as the bottom, this thing must be going up in these curves.
Exactly. Yeah. These sort of bathtub rings here, you can see, mimic the shape of the ground surface here. And so that's one piece of evidence that apparently this thing is to some degree lurching as it moves up. This very prominent ring, and in fact possibly these other rings, too, are also partly due to changes in weather. For example, this material up here has probably been rained or snowed on subsequent to it coming out of the ground, whereas this is fresh material that hasn't ever experienced rain or snow, so it has a different character.
How'd you collect this sample?
By flying by in a helicopter and basically dragging a big bucket along the ground and sort of scooping it up. Again, it's been too dangerous for people to work out there on foot. That may change if the eruption sort of quiets down and they'd be willing to actually go into the crater. Okay, so this is kind of my overview of pertinent facts about this eruption and the hypothesis that's motivated by those facts. We have this quasi-steady solid-state extrusion going on that has long-term rates that range from about 1 to 3 cubic meters a second. And that extrusion is accompanied by these repetitive quasi-periodic small earthquakes. And the extruded plug itself is surfaced with this striated granulated fault gouge. So the hypothesis that motivates is fairly obvious, I think. The extrusion is driven by magma pressure pushing against the base of this accreting solid plug. And in my view, what's happening is that solid plug is slipping frictionally and incrementally as it moves its way up along the conduit. And that these repetitive stick-slip cycles are what are generating these semi-periodic small earthquakes. So to try to test that hypothesis, or at least to refine the hypothesis and formalize it, I've developed a model of the process, which is what the rest of this talk will focus on. So conveniently, I've given this model this SPASM acronym, which simply means seismogenic plug of ascending solidifying magma. And the basic idea here is quite simple. We have this plug of solid rock. It's being pushed out of the ground by magma pressure. It's being resisted, of course, by the weight of the rock and by boundary friction acting along the margins. There are a number of sort of mediating influences. The fact is that the plug can change its mass, of course. It can lose mass by eroding off the surface. It presumably gains mass through accretion at its base, where we have the transition from liquid to solid here, which in reality is probably sort of a mushy, gradual transition. But from a mechanics standpoint, I think it's just fine to treat it as basically just being a liquid-solid transition. The magma density itself can evolve, and the magma has some compressibility. The volume, of course, of this conduit can effectively evolve as a function of displacement of this plug, and also as a function of compression or pressurization that takes place as the magma pressure changes. The whole thing is driven in this simple model by just a constant magma influx from below. Obviously, a more complex model could be formulated where you look at a varying magma influx, but in my view, that's sort of a secondary problem. And then, of course, one thing that we're trying to predict is the velocity of this plug as it's working its way out of the ground.
So what is the relation between the materials that are not part of the plug and the materials that are? Is it the same kind of rock, or is it?
Well, chemically, it's the same rock, and the only real difference is that it's going through the transition from essentially liquid to essentially solid. And again, that's probably a gradual, mushy sort of transition.
That's at the bottom of the plug.
That's at the bottom of the plug.
The distinction is the walls.
The walls are old rock that date from some prior time in the history of Mount St. Helens. That are essentially solid rock that are elastically and inelastically deformable. And in this case, I'm just treating them as elastically deformable. So effectively, the boundaries of this conduit are established, and they're only migrating in response to elastic deformation in this model.
What is the chemical composition?
It's dacite, which is a kind of an average sort of volcanic rock, typical of Mount St. Helens, and it's really very much like the rock that erupted at Mount St. Helens back in the 1980s. One difference between this dacite and what erupted explosively in the 1980s is that it has a lower gas content. And that's a bit of a mystery. The people who study volcanic gases are surprised by the low gas content of this magma. And that low gas content is probably responsible for the fact that there's been very little tendency for this to be explosive. Instead, this sort of quiescent eruption. So anyway, to kind of summarize then what goes into this model, we of course have conservation laws, momentum of the solid plug, mass conservation of the plug, momentum of the fluid beneath the plug, mass of the conduit fluid. That's supplemented by so-called constitutive laws or constitutive rules, which are quite simple, or at least the first two are very simple. I'm assuming that the conduit walls are simply elastically compliant. The fluid beneath the plug is elastically compressible. And then there's this more problematic constitutive law. What is the friction rule for the plug interacting with the conduit walls? In other words, what's the friction rule that governs that fault gouge that I passed around? And then the main simplifying assumptions are that I'm simply going to treat this as a one-dimensional problem, and that the whole system is driven by this constant influx of magma from below. So the system of governing equations that emerges from that picture then can be reduced to just a set of three simultaneous equations. The first one, of course, is just momentum conservation for the plug. U here is the velocity of the plug. M naught is its original mass. So in this case, I'm not looking at early time behavior of the system. I'm looking at what's happened after the extrusion has already emerged from the surface and has established itself as a body that has some mass and is already interacting in sort of a steady state way with its surroundings. Obviously, there's a different set of dynamics involved if you want to deal with the initial phases of the problem when it was pushing its way out of the ground. Momentum conservation here, of course, is going to the flux is, or the motion is driven by pressure at depth. It's resisted by this friction, this boundary friction, which is possibly, well, almost certainly, strongly nonlinear. If in fact it has any rate dependence at all, it could be that it's rate independent. This term arises simply from the fact that we have changing mass in the system, and kappa is sort of the mass change coefficient. Then there's an equation that describes evolution of the magma pressure on the plug base. This equation 2 has a nonlinearity, although it's a relatively weak one, because it turns out that V here, the volume of that magma filled conduit, really doesn't change very much. It's only going to change subtly in response to displacement of the plug and elastic compliance of the conduit walls. And then finally, there's a third equation that describes that evolution of the volume of the conduit. And in many cases, this equation can essentially be ignored because it's not terribly important compared to the other two, and you can show that through scaling arguments. Anyway, here's the friction rule that I decided to investigate as at least a way to start looking at a range of possibilities for how the wall rock interacts frictionally with that fault gouge surfacing the plug. So I'm simply saying that friction depends on the normal stress bounding that plug. And I'm sort of scaling that normal stress by the weight of the plug. So M naught G here is the plug weight. Lambda is a dimensionless scaling factor. It's probably small, probably on the order of 0.1 is what I'm guessing based on what we know about typical states of stress in geologic systems and so on. Mu is a friction coefficient. And then I'm saying that this friction can be rate dependent in the following way. I simply use this inverse cinch function here as basically a way of connecting with a smooth function, a static frictional state here, where the friction coefficient is simply equal to its static reference value, with dynamic states where the friction coefficient is somewhat lower, although we don't really know that it's somewhat lower, and we don't really know what the shape of this function should be, although it's likely that it is concave upward, as I've shown here. Well, because there is evidence, and this is where the experimental evidence is equivocal. There is evidence that some of these materials at these relatively low sliding rates I'm talking about here, bear in mind that I'm talking about rates that are on the order of millimeters per second as opposed to, say, meters per second or something like that, that they do show velocity weakening. On the other hand, of course, I can also look at velocity strengthening with this simply by changing the sign of C. And the reason that I'm focusing particularly on weakening, however, is that that's what leads to interesting behavior. The strengthening case really doesn't give me anything that's very very exciting in a sense. So first I'm going to just describe some analytical results that provide some guidance for interpreting the later numerical results. First off, that set of equations, of course, has a simple steady state solution where the forces are simply balanced dynamically and the friction is simply sufficient to kind of stabilize the system in this steady state, and the magma pressure is just sufficient to keep the magma moving up with this constant flux rate here, Q, which gives us a constant velocity at the ground surface. So that's the steady state solution. And then I'm going to look at deviations from that steady state by basically linearizing the transient system about that steady state and looking at deviations or perturbations from the steady state. And for this purpose, treating the frictional dependence on velocity as simply being a constant. So I'm looking at linear rate dependence now for this simple kind of analytical approach. So then what you find is that these velocity perturbations conveniently obey this very well-known damped force oscillator equation, which is nice, of course, because this is understood so well. It is a somewhat non-standard kind of oscillator equation, and that the quantity that's oscillating is not displacement, but rather velocity. So we're seeing just sort of changes in the upward motion of this plug. And for the simplest case, where we have no change in the mass of the plug, which equates to kappa being zero in this equation, and you can see that kappa occurs in several different places. If kappa is zero everywhere and there's no plug mass change, and if in addition we assume that the friction is simply constant, so it's rate independent, which means C equals zero in this sense, then this equation has a very simple periodic solution that looks like this. And we get this sort of characteristic time scale that comes out of that periodic behavior. And That gives us the opportunity to make a first comparison with predictions of this model with what's observed at Mount St. Helens. A very simple kind of
damped oscillation.
What's that? Yeah, well, in this case, the damping factor goes to zero because I'm setting kappa equals zero and c equals zero in the damping term. So I'm looking at the simplest case scenario. And that allows me to make a simple calculation of the oscillation period, which normally, in its general sense, looks like this, where alpha 1 and alpha 2 are the compressibility coefficients for the wall rock and the magma. V naught, again, is the volume of the magma conduit. M is the mass of the plug. For the case of a cylindrical plug, you can express this in a simpler form. It simply involves the heights of the conduit and the plug and the density of the rock. And then you can plug in some numbers that are reasonable for Mount St. Helens, because these are all things that we can estimate with reasonable accuracy. And by reasonable, I mean that in the case of these numbers, we probably know them pretty well to at least one significant digit, which isn't bad for geophysical problems. Alpha and alpha 1 and alpha 2, we don't know probably quite as well as to a significant digit, but we at least know the order of magnitude. And if we put those numbers in and then look at what the predicted period is, we find that it's 87 seconds. So nicely, these simple analytical calculations give us a result for the oscillation period that's roughly similar to what we've actually observed as being the period between these episodic small earthquakes at Mount St. Helens. Well, then we can also ask about the stability of simple oscillations like that by looking at somewhat more complicated solutions of the damp oscillator equation. And first of all, for the case where kappa equals zero, so again, no mass change of the plug, but allowing for rate-dependent friction, what we find is that the oscillations will either decay or grow depending on the sign of D, this sort of dimensionless damping factor. And of course, D, the sign of D here, will depend on the sign of C. And so this is what I mean, I guess, by saying that the case where rate strengthening friction doesn't give us very interesting behavior, because rate strengthening friction corresponds to C being positive here. And that basically tells us that the oscillations are always going to just damp out, and the system will have this tendency to just get stuck sort of in this steady state. And of course, we don't see it getting stuck in a steady state with respect at least to these small fluctuations that give rise to the small earthquakes. And this is one of the reasons that I think it's probable, although we don't know it yet, it's probable that C is actually negative and that we have rate weakening friction to some degree. You can also look at analytical solutions for the case where kappa is not equal to zero, allowing for growth of the mass of that plug. In that case, the damped oscillator equation can be reduced basically to Bessel's equation through a change of variables. And of course, the solutions of Bessel's equation are well known. And what you find out then is that a slightly different parameter actually controls the stability or the growth of the oscillations. And what you conclude on the basis of this parameter is that there's one case where you can have a combination of rate weakening friction and persistent stable oscillations. And of these four cases, depending on the signs of the growth parameter and the sign of the frictional rate dependence parameter, it's this situation where kappa is greater than zero, meaning that we have growth of the plug mass, but C is less than zero, meaning that we have rate weakening friction. And as long as those two conditions are satisfied, and in addition, they satisfy this criterion, where minus C over kappa is less than 3/2, we're led to believe that we can have persistent six-slip cycles, or at least it's a possibility in that case. But it's not a possibility in these other three cases. And so my initial conclusion from doing this analysis was that it was going to be difficult to find an explanation for these oscillations that gave rise to earthquakes without invoking a continuous growth of plug mass. And that was sort of problematic, because there really wasn't evidence that the mass of the plug was necessarily growing continually in time. But it turns out that non-linearity sort of come to the rescue in this case, because the numerical solution to the non-linear case actually show a different kind of behavior. So returning then to the full set of equations and solving these numerically, including this kind of nonlinear rate-dependent friction. I'll show you some examples of what comes out numerically. I fixed the values of these various parameters here at sort of best guess reasonable values from Mount St. Helens. And what I'm going to focus on is the effects of differences in this frictional parameter C here, which is the thing that controls the sign and the magnitude of the rate dependence of the friction as described by that inverse cinch function. So first of all, you can look at sort of a baseline solution for the case where C equals zero. So that's no rate-dependent friction. And the numerical solution in that case reproduces exactly what you expect from the analytical solution, which is smooth sinusoidal oscillation. So here's our oscillation in velocity giving rise to a displacement history that looks like this, smoothly varying. Accompanying that, this is the oscillation in fluid pressure, which is a nice sinusoid. And the period here that's predicted is exactly the same as the period that you would predict based on the linear analysis. So this is provides some confidence that the numerics are actually working properly, and also provides evidence that this nonlinearity involving U over V is weak, which is something that I had asserted previously. And numerically, this actually provides evidence of that, because it appears that that nonlinearity is playing no role whatsoever in changing the solutions. Okay, so then turning to the case first where we put in rate strengthening friction, a small positive value of C, again with that sort of inverse cinch roll-off. And what you find with rate strengthening friction, and this is why I was saying that it doesn't really produce any very interesting behavior, is that the system starts up and it goes through a small transient. I'm starting the system off at equilibrium here where the forces are all balanced. I then start driving it upward by having magma flux come into the system. And there's a short period of adjustment because the forces have to sort of re-equilibrate to the rate-dependent friction. But they equilibrate quite quickly and just lead to this steady-state extrusion rate as shown here. And here's the corresponding equilibration of the magma pressure. So nothing very interesting happens here, although it could be, it might be interesting to look at this kind of behavior starting out far from equilibrium, which possibly would lend some insight to what happened during the early phases of the eruption, although I'm not sure that this is really even the correct model to use to look at that part of the eruption. Okay, on the other hand, when we put in rate weakening friction, same magnitude of C, but I'm now using a negative value here. So this is quite minimal rate weakening, you know, corresponding to something like a few percent change in the friction coefficient over orders of magnitude of sliding velocity. What we find is that the sinusoidal oscillations are converted into stick-slip cycles like this. So we get a slip event, stick event, slip, stick, and so on. And so we're now seeing this lurching motion as the thing pushes its way out of the ground. And accompanying that, we get this sawtooth oscillation in magma pressure that goes along with that. So this is satisfying because it seems to be able to reproduce the kind of behavior, at least qualitatively, that we would expect based on these episodic small earthquakes. And you can see that the magnitude of these slip events is not very great. We're talking, you know, something on the order of a centimeter here per slip event. Oh, I was going to point out one other thing, which is that if you actually look at the amplitude of these pressure fluctuations, they're remarkably small. You can see that the change here is clear out in the third decimal place, I guess. And what this is saying is that the pressure fluctuations are less than a kilopascal, which is minuscule, of course, compared to the overall pressure in the system, which is megapascals. So we don't really expect to see any geophysical signal in the form of far-field deformation or anything like that that corresponds with these pressure fluctuations. At a distance, this will just look like a steady-state system. Okay, interestingly, in this case where we include the nonlinear friction, there's no tendency for the amplitude of these fluctuations to grow with time, as would have been predicted by the linear analysis. Here I've carried the calculation out 10 times longer, and I'm getting exactly the same pattern of stick-slip cycles that I saw at early times. And this is true to the degree of precision in the computational results. So it's just marching along here with a very repetitive behavior. And this is quite nice because it's basically saying that the nonlinearity in the friction rule can sort of stabilize these oscillations and allow them to continue effectively forever as long as nothing changes in the system to change one of the pertinent parameter values or something of that nature. And then you can also look at each one of those slip cycles and calculate exactly how much energy is expended during each one of those cycles. Here's the slip cycles represented as a series of velocity spikes. And again, you see here that the velocity is only getting up to something on the order of millimeters per second. So it's never moving all that fast. But these are certainly high enough velocities to produce seismogenic slip based on earthquake studies. And it turns out that the energy expended during each one of these spikes is about 3 times 10 to the 8th joules, which is comparable to the energy released in a magnitude 2.2 earthquake. So these are sort of in the right range in terms of the energetics to be corresponding to these individual earthquakes. Although, of course, it's possible that some of the slip is occurring aseismically. And therefore, if anything, you'd expect the earthquakes to be smaller than magnitude 2.2, which is what we normally see. We normally see something more like magnitude 1 or 1.5. If you include mass accretion at the base of the plug, which is not included in those calculations I just showed you, what you find is that the period between the stick slip cycles increases, so the period now has jumped up to something like 2 minutes here, whereas it was closer to 1 minute in the previous one. And you also see that then we get this buildup with time of magma pressure. And that's simply, of course, because as the mass of the plug grows with time, you need more and more pressure to drive it upward. And that, again, goes on sort of stably forever unless something happens to sort of radically change a parameter or something else that's governing the system. But basically, it's this long-term sort of stable growth behavior with the stick slip cycles. Okay, so that's really about as far as I've gone with this. I've only been working on this for a short time. It's as far as I've gone with it in terms of the numerics. And one thing I have not really done yet is any kind of a systematic exploration of the parameter space that's relevant to this system. But it turns out, I think, that the parameter space is likely to actually be quite simple. And you can get insight to that by normalizing the equations. And it turns out that if you normalize those three ODEs, you find that the pertinent parameters are basically the same as you get when you reduce the problem to this single second order ODE, because the parameters that enter into the third first order equation, which is the one governing the evolution of the volume of the magma conduit, are inherently very small. They're parameters that are many, many orders of magnitude smaller than one. So the important parameters basically are these three, which pop out of the second order ODE. And what you find when you put in reasonable values for these parameters is that this thing I'm calling G here, which is kind of loosely a gravitational forcing parameter, is always going to be very large for a system like that at Mount St. Helens, order 1,000 or tens, hundreds of thousands, perhaps even order millions sort of thing. Whereas these other parameters, one of which has to do with the rate of mass growth of the plug, K here, and one of which has to do with the rate-dependent friction, are likely to be quite small, are likely to be order 1 or smaller than order 1. So I don't think, my expectation is that there aren't going to be any real surprises that pop out of kind of trying to explore this parameter space, because I know that this parameter is basically the one that's controlling the dynamics of the system more than any other, and it shouldn't be too difficult to sort of see what the possibilities are. But my hunch is that I've basically seen most of what there is to see already, based at least on this simple model of the system. Okay, so conclusions then. First of all, including this nonlinear rate weakening boundary friction makes the model capable of explaining these stick slip oscillations that I think are occurring as the plug goes up. And I should say, an important point is that we've never actually been able to observe these oscillations directly. We have the indirect evidence in the form of the seismic data, But the slip events, the individual slip events, are so small. You know, they're on the order of millimeters to, at most, about a centimeter per individual event. That's below the resolution of real-time GPS. If we had the kind of GPS out there that's used for geodetic measurements of, say, continental plate convergence or something like that, you could see displacements on the order of millimeters. But the difficulty is that to get that kind of resolution out of GPS, you have to sample lots and lots of data from many satellites over a period of days or more. And by sampling more and more satellite data, you can converge on a very precise solution. Whereas here we have a sort of an inexpensive GPS unit that's translating along at a pretty good clip at 10 meters a day. And so we're getting just a few samples of satellite data for any individual solution. And as a consequence, we just can't resolve things that are in this range of sort of centimeter slip. And we're thinking about lots of alternative ways of trying to do this. Everything from optical techniques to actually getting out there on the ground, for example, and putting in a tilt meter that would be sensitive to very small displacement events. But it hasn't happened yet, and that's partly due to safety concerns. There's a big issue with what can safely be done in the crater. So, in a sense, this is just a hypothesis, but it does seem reasonable in light of the seismic data that we probably are getting these individual slip events as this plug works its way out of the ground. And that those slip events are basically regulated by granular friction. And that's why it would be nice to know more about the nature of the granular friction to better constrain the model. Anyway, use of realistic parameter values does produce six-slip oscillations with roughly the correct period and amplitude to be responsible for these so-called drumbeat earthquakes at Mount St. Helens. Using a nonlinear friction rule of the type that I postulated stabilizes the six-slip oscillation so that we don't have this tendency to get growth or decay of the oscillations over a large part of the parameter space. And therefore, we can get them occurring repeatedly. I should point out that of these small earthquakes, there have been about 500,000 of them to date now. So it's a very large number of a very repetitive small-scale process. If the plug mass changes due to net erosion or accretion, the oscillation period and amplitude change, not surprisingly. The long-term oscillatory behavior of the system is remarkably stable, at least under this set of assumptions that I've used in the model, unless something happens to change one of the pertinent parameter values. For example, if the friction changes for some reason, or there's some kind of change in the system that leads, for example, to what I'm calling a hydrofracturing blowout, which basically means that the wall rock cracks, becomes pressurized enough or weakened enough with time that it cracks and allows for a venting of pressure that leads to an explosion or something like that. So that, there's always the potential for that kind of change. And finally, an interesting issue in my mind, a very interesting issue and somewhat problematic one, is that for the system to settle in to this very sort of well-behaved state that it seems to be in and has been in now for 7 months, presumably, it had to start out relatively close to equilibrium, relative to the kind of equilibrium that I'm using in this model. And yet, to get the eruption to start in the first place, something presumably had to be, or at least one would surmise, that something had to be pretty far from equilibrium. And it raises the whole question of why did the magma rise in the first place? And I really don't have any good ideas for that. And frankly, it's something that the explanations that are usually offered in volcanology for why magma rises are really not terribly satisfying. And it's another problem that I think sort of begs for further study. And to some degree is a problem that involves granular media, because magma, as it rises, often starts to crystallize, and so what you end up with is actually sort of a mush that includes a mixture of solid crystals and liquid, and usually a gaseous phase as well. So another problem I'd like to see further work on. And I will stop at that point.
Thanks very much. Are there any questions?
Yeah,
Jerry. Are you sure that the slip is all, well, I realize you're maybe not sure of anything, but is it worth considering slip that might occur not at the interface but within the plug. That is, the plug might be deforming as it moves.
Yeah, well, one thing I didn't mention about this gouge layer is that where we've been able to sample it, which is only in a couple of places and a pretty crude sampling technique, it looks to be as much as a meter thick. And at a minimum, there's probably some shifting of slip surfaces within that meter thick layer of gouge. And there could even be deformation going on internally relative to that, you know, in something that is becoming, you know, more ductile in a sense, and isn't so much a brittle slip process. But we don't know, is the bottom line.
Well, so another localization question. I mean, should I really think that this plug is, you know, sort of kind of flopping along slips monolithically? Or really should I not think that you know, it slipped a little bit here and a little bit there, and then...
I think in all likelihood it is patchy to some degree. You know, certainly that's the way earthquake faults usually work, is that they're patchy in the rupture process. And so instead of having these sort of uniformly distributed slip events, my guess is that it's actually, you know, it's sort of sticking and slipping alternately in various different locations, which is more complicated than what it can do with my 1D model.
Want to say something more about your parameter lambda? That seemed mysterious.
Yeah. Let me back up to where lambda was shown. What was it first? Yeah, it shows up here in the friction rule. Basically, since I'm using the weight of the plug as a way to sort of scale the normal stress that's acting on the side of the plugs, a useful way to think of lambda, I think, is the percentage of the weight of the plug that could be supported simply by static friction if there were nothing else to support it. In other words, you take away the magma pressure beneath, and somehow this thing, this plug has got to remain suspended by friction.
You say.
Well, it's a way, it's simply a way, basically the reason I've done it this way is that M not G provides a very convenient way to scale the force, the frictional force, and lambda becomes a tuning parameter. And I'm guessing that it's small, because intuitively I would say that only a very small percentage of that plug could be supported by boundary friction. And so I'm setting it equal to 0.1 for the purpose of these calculations I showed you. That's another part of this sort of parameter space that needs to be explored, or see how sensitive it is. And clearly, intuitively, as you make lambda larger, you're going to tend to see larger individual slip events. And therefore a longer period between slip events if you're driving the system with a constant magma influx.
So, Jim, the question is
constant. You were showing seismograms of these events, and it looked to me as if they were complex, and that you ought to be able to do something about the nature of the events from it's obvious. It doesn't look as if they just have a source that is a step function.
Yeah, let me go back to, well, here's a map of the crater. Again, kind of to review, this is something I glossed over, but to the north here, the crater is completely open, because that's where the crater was essentially blown out or removed by a big landslide and blast in 1980. And so you have this horseshoe-shaped crater, here's the new dome, here's the old dome, and so on. The seismometers, well, for example, the one that I showed the data for, this is station HSR, which is on the south side of Mount St. Helens, and so it's actually, it's roughly in this location right here, it's actually outside the crater. The seismic stations that are in close, and there are about three or four of them that are inside the crater, suffer from a number of problems. One is that it's really difficult to do a good installation of a seismometer in the crater, because it's basically rubble. It's filled with rubble. And what you'd like to have, of course, is very solid rock that's attached to something underneath. And that's why the better seismic data actually tend to come from outside the crater rim here. And the seismologists have it is true that in principle with seismic data, especially from multiple locations, you can do inversions to get presumably good resolution of the so-called source mechanism, the amount of slip and the sense of slip that actually generated the earthquake. But the problem is that to do decent quality inversions, you need to have a good velocity model, again, and you need to have a good understanding of what the wave speeds are in the rock. And it also really helps if you have something that's more or less a half space, an elastic half space that has a nice, smooth, planar surface on it. And of course, here we have this tremendous amount of topography that's causing a lot of complications in the wave travel and so forth. And so basically, the seismologists, I sort of pester them about this, and they sort of throw up their hands and they say,
the first question is, are they in detail, exact or close to exact repetitions of the mark?
Oh, sometimes yes, other times no. There have been times when we've seen these so-called clone earthquakes where you can line up the waveforms one after the other and they practically superimpose one upon the other. But then they'll shift and go off somewhere else. And ultimately this is it's an irreversible sort of process where slip is probably occurring in different places at different times, as Bob was suggesting. And so I wouldn't necessarily expect the waveforms over any length of time to look similar to one another.
Probably a silly question, just missing something maybe about the lambda again, but why proportional to the mass at all? I mean, it's normal.
Well, it's because the alternative is to simply make an assumption about the ambient state of stress in the system. And what's typically done in geophysics is you assume lithostatic stress, and you basically, rho gh, where h is depth below the surface, and then apply some factor to that. And I could have done that, but I still would have ended up with a factor similar to lambda, just that lambda would have multiplied rho gh instead of m naught g. Because the bottom line is I don't really know what the state of stress is. It could be modified by the presence of fluids. If you have pressurized fluid, which probably is present, that will modify the state of stress. And so I did it this way, basically just to avoid introducing an additional parameter in the model. Since M naught G was sort of the natural magnitude of the force.
And I guess you're finding also that the actual mass evolution doesn't give qualitatively different behavior.
No.
It's not the dominant thing.
Right.
Probably
right. And in fact, we do have some constraints on that mass evolution simply by, for example, looking at a series of pictures like this. We've actually been able to, we do differencing calculations where we difference volumes between successive images like that. And so we can say something about the rate at which mass is being added or lost to the system. And it's a small rate, it's a small rate relative to the overall extrusion rate.
Dave?
Just on that point, since you mentioned that if the mass changes, you expect the period to change, can you find any correlation of when the thing falls up,
That's something that needs to be done, which I have not done. It would be really interesting to see if when we've seen shifts in period, we can also see some shifts in what we've observed, say, in the photographs and so on. Our time resolution between successive photographs is not great. We have issues with clouds filling the crater and so on, and there's just the cost of acquiring the imagery. So, anything that occurs on the time scale of days, we're not going to be able to compare. But if there are systematic changes that occur on the time scale of months, we should be able to see some shift. And I haven't looked for that yet.
This plug's a kilometer deep or so, you're estimating.
Well, yeah, or I'd say maybe half
so, a kilometer. So these mass changes from the stuff at the top are going to be very small, relatively speaking.
Right. Right.
Well, can I ask this question of the depth of the plug and the rigidity of the motion. If you could show us that side shot of the
plug.
You had a move against this
like
one.
This.
Now, before you run it, the motion looked to me to have a significant amount of rotation to it.
Well, it's the thing is sort of bending in effect. Where it comes out of the ground here, I mean, it's rotating in the sense that it's rising up in this direction as it comes out of the ground, but then it's bending over and moving nearly horizontally by the time you get up to the top here.
The overhead picture should have pushed some stuff off to the side.
Yeah, it's also pushing stuff off to the side.
Well, it's just, if you just took that image and asked where's the center of rotation, you would arrive at a point not very far down.
That's true, yeah. Although it is, in total, it's a complicated three-dimensional motion that's sort of difficult to get a grasp on. Part of the difficulty is that we don't know exactly what's going on beneath the ground or beneath the glacier. This thing is coming up through a glacier that itself is about 200 meters thick. And what's going on beneath the surface, we don't really know. In fact, we don't really even know the shape of it as it comes through the ground.
And I have another question for you.
Okay.
Your model always put a bottom boundary condition fixed mm-hmm. up to a magma. Mm-hmm. That, of course, naturally led you to ask what sets that. How well could you model a system with a magma pressure boundary?
Wouldn't be that difficult. There'd be one more ODE to include, and basically I would just treat that as a Poisson flow up a pipe, and it's a natural thing to do. It's a natural way to extend its work is to drive it that way. But one point about that is that we do have some constraints on what the nature of pressure change is at depth. And those constraints come from far-field geodetic measurements that show movements on the order of millimeters to as much as a couple of centimeters of distant stations that have occurred in response to presumed pressurization or depressurization at depth. And the best inversions of those data basically show that during the onset of the eruption, during those first 10 days or so when material was forcibly pushing out of the ground and there were larger earthquakes and so on, that there was a depressurization event that occurred at about 10, the best, it's hard to resolve these things, the best guess is about 10 kilometers depth, which is magma chamber depth. But that since that time, there's been almost no signal in the far field deformation that would coincide with the depressurization at depth, which makes most of us believe that the system is in this sort of steady state where whatever is coming out at the surface is basically being replenished at depth rather than a kind of a progressive depressurization that's driving it out there.
Depressurization, what do you mean? That something that's given way on top?
Well, basically there's an inflated... Volcanologists tend to draw these cartoons that show magma chambers at depth. They basically look like a thermometer with a bulb on the bottom, and the idea is that bulb has been pressurized, but the magma's sitting there under pressure. Then once the eruption starts, you expect that bulb to depressurize as magma exits the chamber. And I'm not sure that cartoon is even right. I suspect that the reality is probably quite a bit more complicated at depth. But in any event, the geodetic data suggests that there's been a relatively steady throughput through the system for the last 6.5 months.
Can I try a simpler version of this question? And you've got supposedly a half kilometer deep flood, which is hot compared to the surrounding rock, which is chemically essentially identical. So you can work out what excess pressure there should be on that plug, assuming hydrostatic balance between the pressure and the weight of the rock surrounding. And does it compute?
But by excess pressure, are you talking about pressure in the magma beneath
the plug? Now just think your terribly simple model. I assume you've got half kilometer thickness of rock. The landscape, despite the picture, is flat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then you've got this hole, this mm-hmm. plug, of hot and so underdense rock. And so the pressure at the bottom of that plug is too high for the weight of that plug.
Oh, I see.
It
rises, right?
Now, are the numbers within...
Well, the density,
sort of
the density of the plug rock, despite the fact that the rock is hot, it differs minusculely from the density of the surrounding rock. It's really all very similar, and what really controls the bulk density is more the degree of fracturing and so forth in the rock, rather than, say, temperature, for example. But certainly the pressures, the magma pressures at depth required to support that plug are very reasonable, given what we know about sort of typical states of stress in the crust and so on.
Okay.
So you mentioned this particular thing is very non-gaseous. Could have been a bubble have risen, basically, of gas that caused the first motion, and that was it, and set it off?
Well, that's often, most of the explanations of why magma rises have to do with motion in bubbles. And the fact that you have a system that's that for whatever reason, you know, bubbles start to nucleate that hadn't been nucleating before, and rise of those bubbles basically pressurizes the system and starts the eruption off. And I think that's as good an explanation as any, but it then sort of begs the explanation of why did the bubbles start to nucleate when they weren't nucleating before, you know, that sort of thing. So you kind of keep going deeper and deeper trying to suggest explanations.
Well, just to follow up on that, I mean, you actually have an extraordinarily simple dynamical system in the model. And have you simply looked at, you know, sort of the basin attraction properties, and you may have, you know, along your attractive directions, you may be just sucking in so fast that it doesn't matter if you start way out.
That's my...
And so you can, that's easy to compute.
Right. No, that's something that needs to be done. Again, I just haven't spent enough time within America just to look at those kinds of questions. But you mean start about some distance from equilibrium and see if it's going to spiral into a fixed attractor, sort of.
It may be so strongly attracting it.
Yeah.
Well, is that to some extent you had actually computed that?
And must have
not exactly.
Right. Yeah, at least when it starts out a relatively small distance where I started, it does attract very quickly to the steady state.
Are there any other attractors you know of that would compete with this one?
Well, depends on if you look at that, I guess, as a geologist or a physicist. You know, certainly the typical behavior of volcanoes is not like this. Typically, they tend to be more chaotic in the sense that you'll get periods of quiescence punctuated with explosions and so forth, and so there doesn't seem to be a strong tendency for it to attract some sort of stable, steady state. But on the other hand, the models for those kinds of eruption cycles have so many unknowns relative to this relatively simple model that I've put together that really I just don't feel like they have a lot of explanatory power because you consider the models are so. So they have so many parameters that you can make them do almost anything that you like.
But in your own model, can you make it do anything else, no matter how far you start from equilibrium?
No, I'm not sure, but I need to explore that. I mean, the one thing that I have learned is that the insights from the simple analytical results are not necessarily relevant, or they don't provide all the insight you'd like when you have a nonlinearity in the problem. So I do need to investigate that.
Sure. Is there anything about the temperature distribution within the plug? Anything at all?
The only real.
I'm asking because of its possible impact on the ability of it to flow.
Yeah. The only hard data we have are from the infrared imagery, which does show that the hottest cracks that we can see into do have these temperatures in as high as 600 or 700 degrees C, which again is only a couple of hundred degrees removed from the solidus temperature for that material.
Well, let me not empirically, but just from is there a thermal model? If there's a long sample model, it would say something about what the heat flow is like.
Yeah, well, there's not really a straightforward heat flow model in a sense because the system, I mean, it's certainly not a simple conductive system. There's no doubt a lot of interaction with fluid, and whether that involves cracks or whether it's just fluid in the surrounding rock and glacier and so on. And there's a lot of convective component, I think, in the heat transfer. So we don't really have a quantitative model for that. There are constraints on the thermal history that come from the mineralogy, and what I mean by that is that the petrologists, the people who study the rocks, collect samples and they look at the size of hornblende crystals and ask questions about under what conditions can you grow a hornblende crystal of this size, assuming that you have magma ascent rates of Wesenschaft such and so on. And basically, they come to the conclusion that that the rock probably is solidifying at a depth just a few hundred meters beneath the surface, which is consistent with what the physical data would tell you. And it's also remarkable. I mean, to me, it's amazing that if the solidification is only going on, say, less than a kilometer beneath the surface, it's amazing that it's been content to be so stable that way, and the liquid rock never reaches the surface.
So it certainly must be flowing.
Oh, heat is flowing, yes.
You're saying that heat flow might not even be significant compared to the other sources of heat transfer.
I wouldn't necessarily say that it's insignificant, but it's basically not a part of the problem that we have a quantitative model for at this point.
Any more questions?
Let's see what happens.
Yeah.